Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall, and in this episode, I'm going to be talking to Caitlin Co'Leary, a PhD student at Virginia Tech, about fossilized pigments. We've discussed color before with Maria McNamara in episode 7, but we focused on structural color. This episode addresses the interpretation of pigments in the fossil record, and we're launching it to coincide with a brand new study out in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America. Since there's a lot of terminology involved, like melanin and melanosomes, as well as aspects of biology, physics, and geology, you should really head over to our website where you can see what we're going to be talking about in this episode. We've got pictures, diagrams, charts, and videos to help illustrate it all. As for the interviews on the latest research, we always have great fun releasing these, and they've been doing really well, so we're glad you're enjoying them too. If you're an academic with some new research coming out, drop us a line. We'd love to share your story as well. I'll be back at the end of this interview when I'll be introducing you to the latest member of our PaleoCast team, so please hang around until then. But in the meantime, I hope you enjoy this episode about melanin. Thank you very much for joining us today then, Caitlin.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Everyone has their own unique and individual way of getting into the field of paleontology. What was yours?
Well, my mom swears I was leading expeditions in my backyard when I was 3 years old. But I wasn't one of those kids that grew up super into dinosaurs. It didn't actually happen for me until a lot later. I studied anthropology for my undergrad, and one of the class field trips we went on was to the La Brea Tar Pits in Los Angeles. And I was just so intrigued with the place that I volunteered there for a summer. And it's just extraordinary. It's right in the middle of the city, but it's almost untouched. So you can be sitting outside on the grass and look up and feel like you've almost just seen a giant ground sloth walk by. So it really captured my imagination. And since then, I've had so many amazing opportunities and worked with so many brilliant people that my fate is pretty much sealed. So that's what led me to do my master's in Bristol. And now I'm working on my PhD at Virginia Tech.
So you are from Los Angeles, though, aren't you?
Yes.
Okay. I remember going to the La Brea Tar Pits when we went to cover the SVP conference. So we've got all my pictures from that on, I think it was 2 years ago now, was it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Time flies.
It does.
So why did you get to start work on melanin and not pursue anything at the tar pits?
Well, I had no idea that you could find something like melanin preserved in fossils before I started at Bristol. I'd actually done mostly dinosaur paleontology up until that point, where you really only find bones. So it was really the concept of exceptional preservation that I became really interested in at first. And that sort of naturally led to questions about taphonomy. And when it came time to choose a master's project, I was really intrigued by this project that Jakob Winther was offering, looking at the preservation of melanin.
Yeah, he sounds like a good supervisor.
Yeah, he's great.
I should probably have to throw that in there, seeing as he's my supervisor as well. Get my brownie points.
Yep.
So what is melanin?
Well, melanin is the pigment that colors our hair and our skin. It's all over the animal kingdom and in everything from integuments like feathers. It's also found in organs. It's in cephalopod ink. And so it's a pigment.
And how is it produced? Do we synthesize it in our cells?
Yeah, it's produced by oxidation of tyrosine, which is an amino acid, and then polymerization. So you can actually see the process of melanogenesis if you're one of those lucky people who can go on holiday and sit on the beach and get a really lovely tan. Then you're actually watching it happen.
I just grow a lot of freckles and they all merge into one another.
Mine have never merged. I just get burned and then more freckles, but they've never actually merged enough to make me look tan.
And then the melanin is actually stored inside our cells.
Then. Yeah, correct. Yep.
Okay. And what kind of colors can we produce? I mean, if we think about hair, we've got black, brown, red, and freckles, tans, that's all a bit brown. So is it just kind of browns and reds and blacks?
Yeah. Yeah, melanin is responsible for every normal hair color you can think of. So black, brown, gray, blonde, red. And there are two types. There's eumelanin, which is responsible for black, dark brown, gray, and blonde, depending on the concentration. And then pheomelanin, which is responsible for red.
And what's the difference between them, other than the color that they produce? How is it like a chemical difference?
Yeah, there's a chemical difference. So it's actually a difference in oligomer structures. So you find benzothiazine in pheomelanin, and you find DHI and DHICA in eumelanin during one step of the melanogenesis process. But for our purposes, we found that sulfur content was a good way of distinguishing them. So the molecular peaks that we were looking at for pheomelanin often contained sulfur.
And we're talking the same kinds of chemicals between different groups of animals as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, but then pigment isn't the only way in which colour can be produced. I think in one of our very first paleocasts, I think it was like episode 7 or 8, we did coloration in the fossil record. And I remember there being a lot of structural colour, which really surprised me because I thought that so much was based on pigments. But then you've got things in... Is it like beetles where they have reflectors and all stuff to do with iridescent colors?
Yeah, exactly. Iridescence is a really good example of structural color. And it's interesting because you actually, if you look at an iridescent feather and you move it around in the light, it turns these like really shiny, lovely green colors. But it's actually pigmented with melanin. And the feather itself is actually black or dark brown, but it's the structures in it and the reflection of the light that make it look that green color.
Wow. So color isn't just one or the other. It can be an interplay of pigment and structural color as well.
Yeah, it very often is.
Oh, sounding complicated already. So which kind of animals are able to do that? Is it just in feathers?
No, you said beetles. You find structural color in beetles as well. But it does explain why you see such a variety of colors in feathers, because melanin is only responsible for like those normal hair colors that you see. So you see such bright colored birds because of iridescence and from structural color.
And is there any overlap in how the structures are produced? So can reds only be produced by melanin, or can they also be produced by structural color as well? If so, like we say, like we saw a red animal, can we just point to it straight away and say melanin?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm sure that there could be an overlap, but you do get these really bright red colors just from melanin itself.
So if we look at the fossil record now, getting soft parts preserved is incredibly rare. And we're talking about pigments, which are inside of cells. So surely that's even rarer still. How do you go about even trying to find melanin?
Yeah, well, we have to start with fossils that are exceptionally preserved. So that's a very small proportion of fossils to start with. But you do find them, and they preserve things like feathers, they preserve hair, and that's where we look for melanosomes. That's where we look for the presence of melanin.
But even still, you're going to have cells preserved, aren't you?
Well, yeah, we find, from what we've looked at so far, we find melanosomes preserved in these carbonaceous films that you find preserved on top of these things like feathers. And that's where you find the cells preserved. And if you're finding the feather, then there's a chance you're going to find more inside the feather if the preservation is that awesome.
How far back can you look in the fossil record? Is it only things that are very, very recent, things like that have feathers, so you can't look any further back than the Mesozoic?
Well, actually, the oldest fossil that we looked at in our study was a Carboniferous fish. So it was about 300 million years old. And when you look at it, the way it's preserved, you just see this dark black spot where its eye once was, and that's where we found melanin preserved.
Oh, do we have melanin in our eyes then as well?
Yes, we do. Huh.
That was kind of a redundant point, but yes. All the fossils that I've ever found, though, have been well, rock coloured. There's never been any that have any coloration on them. So how rare is it to find candidates that you think, hey, this one has fossil melanin in it?
Well, you start with exceptionally preserved fossils, and you can see the areas that you would expect to have melanin in them are generally dark. It's this dark carbonaceous film that covers the fossil. And it's not usually over the entire fossil. It's usually in the areas where you would expect to find melanin. So it's usually if there's hair preserved, if there's an eye preserved, if there's a feather preserved, those are the areas that you would expect to find it. But if you find these structures preserved, we'll just check it out and see if there's any melanin preserved, because it does seem to be pretty common.
And so is it just simply a case of saying this bit of the fossil is coloured, there's the evidence for melanin? I mean, is it like you got, say you said with the eye spots, so you got a black eye, there's your black melanin. If you had perhaps, say, a red pigmented feather, there's your evidence for red pigment.
Well, we actually look at the shapes of the melanosomes, which are correlated to the color in modern animals. So there are two different shapes of the melanosomes themselves.
What's the melanosome opposed to melanin?
Okay, so melanin is the chemical pigment that gives color. Melanosomes are the organelles that contain melanin. So there are two different types that go along with the two types of melanin. So there are eumelanosomes and pheomelanosomes, and they're distinct in shape. So in modern feathers, for example, you can look at these structures microscopically and see the two different shapes correlate to what color the feather is. So eumelanosomes tend to be more sausage-shaped, and pheomelanosomes are generally more spherical.
Okay, so your little ball ones are red, and yep. Your basically other colors are sausages.
Yep.
Right, okay. That sort of sounds a bit like the shape of bacteria. And if we're talking about something that goes in the inside of a cell, then you're looking around the same size as a bacteria. How can you be sure that, I mean, everything in the fossil record's dead, it's been taphonomically altered, it's been decomposed. How can you say that it's melanin and not bacteria?
Well, that's actually something that scientists have been asking for quite a while now. And when these structures were first described in the fossil record in the 1980s, they were described as bacteria. But Jakob Winther, he published on a Cretaceous feather in 2008, which had black and white bands. And he found that these structures, these melanosomes, well, that we now know are melanosomes, were preserved in the black bands, but they were absent in the white bands. So if we were looking at bacteria, you would expect it to cover the entire feather and not just be in the black bands. So that's when he suggested that they were actually melanosomes. And the best evidence that we have now is that you find the chemical signature of melanin in direct association with these structures. So there's really no question at this point.
And Jakob came up with all that himself. What a clever guy.
What a clever guy. We all love Jakob.
Yeah, he's so cool. yeah, I might leave that on the editing floor, actually.
He'll love it.
But throughout the history of a fossil, as it's being fossilized, it's going to get squished, it's going to get heated, it's going to get compressed. How can you be sure that the shape of the melanosome, the organelle that produces the melanin, if the shape distinguishes what color it melanin it produces, how do you know that it's not been deformed and squished into a different shape? How do you know your little spheres haven't been elongated to become sausages?
Yeah, well, it's extraordinary that we find these structures at all. But remember, they're in exceptionally preserved fossils. So even though they've been squished and buried for millions of years, they are in conditions that preserve something as fragile as a feather. And experiments have been done to look at how the shapes and sizes of melanosomes may be altered. And there's definitely some evidence that suggests that they can be affected by higher temperatures and pressures. But generally, we found that they do retain their shape. And when you combine with the chemical evidence, since we're able to distinguish between eumelanin and pheomelanin, if you look at the structure and then are able to identify the chemical that goes along with it, the actual melanin, then you can be quite confident in deciphering between the two.
So the actual chemical composition remains unaltered in the rock, because when you think of the lithification of fossils, it being turned into rock, then all of the chemistry changes. That's how you get fossils preserved. So are we still able to see the chemical difference between the melanin and the rock?
Yes, we're able to see the chemical difference. It's definitely changed. We've been calling it diagenetically altered melanin because it's not exactly the same, but it's still comparable to modern melanin.
And how do you test that?
So we used basically a chemical fingerprint where we looked at 55 peaks that are found in modern melanin, and we compared those to the fossils to see if we could find traces of melanin in the fossils as well.
And it matched? Your peaks all lined up?
Yeah, the peaks all lined up.
That sounds so nice.
It was very lovely, actually. But we do find a difference in intensity. And when we plot them, we actually do see a difference between the two.
And this was what your new study was on?
Yes.
Matching these up. Okay, and so we've got a difference. With all the peaks match up to say that what we're looking at is melanin, which is really nice and lovely. But then there's a difference between the peaks. Can you say, or can you use that difference between the peaks to suggest how much the melanin has been altered in its lifetime?
Yeah, well, that was something that we tried to do with these experiments that we did. So we used the same maturation experiments that were used previously to look at how the shapes of melanosomes are altered, but we looked at the chemistry to see how that was altered. And it's actually... So we looked at all of them using TOF-SIMS, which I know I'll explain eventually. Sorry. And so we saw that when you do these maturation experiments, you're actually able to kind of create this in-between where you have your modern melanin on one side, you have your fossil melanin on the other side, and the matured samples fall right in the middle. So it's sort of this lovely... road that you can kind of go down of melanin degradation.
So TOF-SIMS, is that the chemical fingerprinting?
Yes. So TOF-SIMS stands for time of flight secondary ion mass spectrometer. And it's a mass spec instrument. And that's where we use the chemical fingerprint, because you get all of this data, all this molecular data, when you use the TOF-SIMS, and the chemical fingerprint really helps to narrow it down and see what exactly you're looking at.
So the TOF-SIMS that you've mentioned is a pretty complex process to describe. We just had a go at it for about 10 minutes and failed. So hopefully we're going to put this on the website. So if you want to have a look at this cutting edge process and understand the bits of the physics and the chemistry that goes into it, make sure you check out this post on our website. So all of this talk about squished melanosomes and heated melanosomes, and then before and after fossilization, which animals did you actually look at? Which animals did you have modern and fossil specimens of to compare the melanosomes in?
So we actually looked at quite a lot of animals. I extracted melanin from feathers, squid ink, and frog tissues. So those were our modern samples from a lot of different feathers. So pretty much a range of all the colors that you could imagine pigmented in feathers. And then we compared them to fossil feathers, some cephalopod ink sacs, which were really well preserved, some frogs, which were awesomely preserved. They just, like, you could see the outline of them perfectly. You could see their little feet and everything. And bats from the Eocene, which were also extraordinarily preserved, and a fish from Maison Creek.
So we've got our modern representatives, we've got our fossil representatives, and we know that the melanin between different animals is constant, but how do we know if it's temporally constant as well, that it's not evolved throughout time?
Yeah, well, this is something that we didn't really know going into this. So we've found that we can compare them. And that's really, I guess, the best way I can answer that question is that it doesn't seem like that it's changed at all, really.
So your conclusions, therefore, is that we can interpret fossilized color from the structure of the melanosomes?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we found that this diagenetically altered melanin is preserved in conjunction with the melanosomes in fossils. And so there is a correlation between the shape of the melanosome and the chemical structure or the chemical signature that we know from eumelanin and pheomelanin in the fossils. So it's nice to use a combination of techniques where you look at both the structure of melanosomes and the chemistry of the melanin. But since we see this correlation, we can say that we can use the shape of the melanosome to look at the color.
Right. And this is where I'm going to sound a bit of a jerk. But
go on.
Your study shows that fossilized frogs were probably frog-colored, and they show that fossilized ink was probably black. What's it tell us that we didn't already know?
Well, one of the things that I think that we can tell from looking at color in the fossil record is when we look at color patterns. Color is extremely informative in biology. We know from studying living animals that what colors they are tell us a lot about the environments that they live in, how they protect themselves, and how they attract mates. So this information isn't something that has been accessible from the fossil record until now. Now we can look at color in the fossil record. So even though we know that squid ink is the color of squid ink, it's still really exciting. And the prospect of looking at color patterns will help us to understand behavior better from the fossil record.
It gives us paleoecology. It colors our interpretations of the past.
Exactly.
Oh, that's beautiful.
It is.
So what kind of animals have we been able to reconstruct the colors of?
Well, so far, the shapes of melanosomes have been used to reconstruct the color of a number of dinosaurs. Cynoceropteryx is an example of the first ginger dinosaur, which is quite awesome. And it's been used in a few others. Anchiornis was used. They found melanosomes preserved in Anchiornis and reconstructed its color as well. And Archaeopteryx is another example of using melanosomes to look at what color it would have been.
So the examples of the dinosaurs that you've just mentioned, they would all be theropods, the meat-eating ones with the feathers, yeah?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But you said before about feathers using an interplay between the pigment and the structural color. So if there is that interplay, how can you be sure that any given fossil, you're not just getting half of the story?
Yeah, sure. So this is something, I think this is a direction that we're going in now when it comes to looking at fossil color. But I know that when you look at the melanosomes in iridescent feathers, they actually look quite different than melanosomes normally. So they're actually like hollow. And I think that that has something to do with iridescence itself. So there's a chance that you would be able to see evidence of iridescence in the melanosome itself.
And have there been any fossils you've identified thus far as potentially being iridescent?
Yes, there's a mesel feather that Jakob describes that we actually have a really lovely ion map for from the TOFSIMS that we can put up on the website to everyone can see it. And yeah, it has these hollow melanosomes. And so there's a very good chance that it was actually iridescent.
So how might color go on to further paint our understanding of extinct organisms?
Well, like I said before, we learn a lot about living animals based on the color that they are. So information regarding behavior that we can't access in the fossil record is more of a potential. I think that it's just amazing that we can finally know what color these animals were. Because if you think about it, we all grow up seeing books with pictures of dinosaurs and things in them, but they're all just made up the way they look. Nobody actually knew what color they were, or what they actually looked like when they had skin or feathers. So I think that that's one of the most exciting things to come out of all of this, is that we can finally, with certainty, draw pictures of dinosaurs.
Well, Caitlin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So in the introduction, I mentioned that we'd be introducing our latest PaleoCast member, and here she is. She's not gone anywhere. It's Caitlin.
Hello.
So Caitlin, you're now the latest PaleoCast member. What are you going to be doing for us?
Well, I guess I'm the American correspondent, so it's nice that I'm over here in the States, so I can probably talk to people that you guys wouldn't be able to talk to otherwise. And I'm going to go to some conferences. I'm going to go to SVP. I'm going to go to GSA. And yeah, I don't know. I don't know what it's going to be like. I don't know what I'm getting myself into, but I'm looking forward to it.
I think it is really important to have a correspondent stateside, since that's the two-thirds of our audience. So giving something back to America.
Yeah.
And what kind of episodes are you looking to produce? What do you really want to explore?
Well, I don't know. One thing that would be really fun would be during field seasons to go out and do like from the field interviews. I feel like that would be really interesting. I think I've driven over 20,000 miles this summer. So I was in Arizona, I was in New Mexico, I was in Wyoming, and we were just all over the place doing a lot of really interesting field work. So I think that that would be something I could definitely bring to the team.
And what were you looking for? Was it something to do with your research, or are you just volunteering to go on just digs all over the place?
Well, my advisor, Sterling Nesbitt, and he studies archosaurs. So we were going all over looking, basically digging up Triassic creatures. Most of them at places where he's been doing field work for quite a while.
Oh, well, we'll have to get him on the show if he'll be on.
Yeah, I'm sure he'd love that.
Right, well, we'll look forward to what you get at SVP and GSA, and hopefully you can join us again next time.
Awesome.
See you later.
See ya.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule, and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programs. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.